Text 51551. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
51551 Ray at RTE.ie. Many Things Under Rock is a new book by David Scheel. David is a professor of marine biology at Alaska Pacific University. It's a fascinating study of octopuses, who are sometimes seen as alien and otherworldly. But as an expert of the eight armed creatures, David tells us they are more like us than we might think. Hello, David.
Hello, Ray. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah. Octopuses, fascinating creatures. You were told way back that they're impossible to study.
Yeah. When I first started working with octopuses, I had just come to Alaska and I was in Cordova, which is a thriving fishing village on the shores of Prince William Sound. And, you know, I sort of asked kind of a basic ecological question: what sort of habitats do you find them in? And people reported, well, you know, they're anywhere at all, but you won't be able to find them. So they're all over the place, but you can't find them. And so that was my advice from the beginning of how to look for octopuses.
Yeah, flexible, boneless, slippery, and elusive. That's how you describe them in your book. What caught our eye about your book was an article I read, and will you tell us that story about the tentacles of octopuses in a bucket?
Yes. So this is a story that has a bit of a sometimes a horrifying feel to it for people who are friends of octopuses, but I told it in the book not because I really identified with it, but because it really made me think about how the octopus was like us and how the octopus was different. So I was in one of the villages on the shores of Prince William Sound many years ago now, and I was working with Alaska Native elders. And you know, these people live in communities where the nearest grocery store is hundreds or thousands of miles away, and they forage in the sea for their food. Mm. And so they're eating, you know, fish and other animals. And this is just a way of life in Alaska, and it's part of their culture. And so they were showing me how to find octopuses, because we'd identified that as one of the big challenges, right? Is they're hard to find. Mm. And so these were the guys who knew how to find them. And so they were kind enough to take me out and while they went fishing. And so when we were successful, they brought back octopuses for the table. And so I'm standing on the dock with this fella, and he's cleaning the octopus, getting it ready for meal prep. And he took off the arms and he tossed them in a bucket. And then a fella came by, and you know, they started chatting about village life and whatnot. And you know, I was just sat there, and I wasn't really part of the conversation because I was not a member of the village. I didn't know the community that well. And so I was just sort of listening with half an ear and watching the bucket. And I was kind of perplexed to see the arms were still moving. And they, not only were they moving, but they appeared to be almost coordinated, in the sense that each arm would go crawl tip first up the walls of the bucket.
Spooky.
And yeah, towards the top. Yeah. And from a, you know, if you took a half a step back so you couldn't see the bottom of the bucket, You couldn't tell whether there was a intact octopus in there or, you know, these arms. And it really made me think about how the octopus gets its oxygen, how its blood circulates, how its nerves are organized. And there's been a lot of talk, you know, more recently about the ability of the octopus arms to coordinate behaviors without the brain. And okay, this is exactly what I was seeing.
So explain that to us, because with the human setup, right, we have a brain, and it's central communications, really. It, you know, we think, move your hand, and our hands move. We move our feet, blah blah blah. That's the way it works. But it's not the same for the octopus. Does each tentacle have a mind of its own?
Well, you know, that gets said a lot, and there's some truth to it. So big difference is that there's, you know, 95% or so of all of the neurons, all of the nerve cells in the human body are in the brain.
Mm.
But in the octopus, that corresponding number is about a third of the nerve cells are in the brain. And most of those are in the two optic lobes. So where are the rest? They're distributed throughout the body. And so, and some of the motion of the arms, the passing of things from one sucker to the next, even the ability to bend the arm and extend it, are really coordinated by the nerve centers that are, these are tiny little nerve centers that are distributed throughout the arm. There's ganglion, they're called, at the base of each sucker. There's ganglion, there's a sucker pair ganglion, and then there's a main cord that runs through each arm that has been likened to a spinal cord. And so that's where this notion of a brain in each arm comes from. But I think it's a little, you know, it depends how you think about a brain. Yes, there are nerve cells and coordination in each arm. If that's a brain to you, then okay.
Right.
But if you're asking, is an octopus made up of 9 individual brains that are co-equally sitting around a table having conversations, you know, I think that's pushing the metaphor pretty far.
Okay. And one of the tentacles is adapted for mating in the male,
yes.
Is it, or in both?
Yeah, in the male.
Yeah.
Yeah. So on the... So if you face the same direction as the octopus and you go down between the eyes and divide the arms, you know, sort of left side and right side of the body, then if you go down to the third arm down on the right side of the body, and you look all the way out to the tip, if it suckers all the way out, it's probably a female. But for most species of octopuses, the males will not have suckers all the way out. The suckers will sort of tape end, and there'll be a different sort of organ, smoother skin, some anatomy, but it depends on exactly what's there. And that's referred to as the hectocotylus, or the hectocotylized arm. And that organ at the tip of the third right arm of the male aids the male in placing they make a sperm packet, and it aids the male in placing the sperm packet inside the female's reproductive tract.
Right. Yeah. Very genteel. Just placing it in.
Nice. Yeah. And then the females choose which sperm they want to use to fertilize. So right. Not only do they have to agree to mate, then they have to decide they want to actually use that sperm.
They're fascinating creatures to look at. So they have the 8 tentacles, that's where they get their name, octopus. Then they have this huge, looks like a huge head. So what are we seeing there? Where's the brain? Where's the internal organs?
Yeah. Well, you know, so you start with the eyes, which are in the middle of the body, right? And that's the head. The eyes are on the head.
Mm.
And then if you think about where's the mouth is downward facing in the center of the circle of arms. And one way that I like to think about it is the arms are essentially these prehensile lips that surround the mouth and help it handle food.
Mm. And there's there's a beak in the mouth, is there?
There's a beak inside the mouth, much like a parrot beak, but more surrounded with muscle. Yeah. So,
right. Okay. Right.
And then behind the eyes, you have that sac you mentioned that does indeed look like a very high forehead or something like that. But that's actually the body sac of the animal. And so the stomach is in there, and the reproductive organs are in there, and the gills are in there. And so that's actually where all the organs are contained, is in that sac.
How many species of octopus are there?
There's about 300 in our continental shelf coastal seas.
Yeah.
But there's more out in the open ocean, and there's more yet in the deep sea, and we're discovering new species all the time.
And you go and search, and there's loads of stories about huge ones. What's the biggest verified octopus?
Yeah. So I work with the largest octopus species here in Alaska. It's the giant Pacific octopus. And it does get up to 100 pounds and larger. And one of the fun things about working with these guys is that "and larger" kind of shades from, as you say, verified scientific fact up into less well verified, up into positively mistaken, and from there to you know, mythology.
And those, when you talk about mythology, it is very possible that when we read about monsters of the sea, that they were quite large octopus. Is that what the way it was when we read about monsters of the sea in historical, you know, literature?
It could be, but also exaggerated, right?
Like, yeah, okay.
We've never had those octopuses that took sailing ships down. That seems, to the best of our knowledge, that seems unlikely.
Uh-huh, right. Now, you had a pet octopus called Heidi.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. yeah. So,
How are you? My name is David. I had a pet octopus called Heidi. It's a good opening line, David. So you built an aquarium, very large aquarium, in your living room.
Yeah, and BBC and PBS made a documentary about this. BBC, the octopus in my house, and we, you know, we had a. They were very interested in seeing how a scientist, I think, would react to having a pet octopus. And it was fascinating. But really, the documentary ended up, my daughter, Laurel, sort of stole the show, thankfully. You know, this is not a criticism. This is praise. And she and Heidi became the center of the whole thing. Uh-huh. And I had been saying all along, yes, let's make a documentary about octopuses. And they were like, well, we want to make it about a scientist. I was like, no, make it about octopuses. So we have this great documentary about octopuses and in relationship to my daughter Laurel, which I thought worked out really well. And then in the book, Many Things Under a Rock, my daughter Laurel also did the illustrations for that.
Yes, and lovely illustrations. Well, yeah. So you were like, because I did psychology, and we trained a white Norwegian albino rat to do things. You were doing that with Heidi. That when she pulled the ball, it buzzed the buzzer and lit a light, and then she got rewarded. And the purpose of that was to see if she knew you were there even when you weren't there. Is that it? That she knew that there was a presence, that, and by doing this, she could bring you back into the room.
Right. I was trying to just play in a playful way, play around with the idea of how does the octopus represent the world that she can't touch?
Yes.
Right. Because outside the tank, you know, in captivity, that octopus can see us, but they can't touch us. And we come and go and they can't follow us. And so I was curious, you know, representing that in the octopus's world, how could we build some sort of thing that could be touched that would allow them to manipulate the world beyond, and what the octopus would do with that. And, you know, so the first step was training Heidi to, play with a rubber ball. So we put a rubber ball on a line and bounced it around. And she loved this game. She just had so much fun with it because, you know, there's a lot of tug of war involved, and she could pounce on the ball and just, you know, just like a puppy. It was a lot of fun.
And how intelligent are they? You know, they say pigs are intelligent. You know, there's a sort of a hierarchy of intelligence when it comes to animals. Where does the octopus lie in that hierarchy?
Yeah. Well, octopuses are clearly intelligent, and I like to think of their intelligence according to the components of it. So they're very persistent, and they're very curious. So they'll investigate almost anything, and they're also very flexible in the sense that they can get into lots of places, but also in the sense that they will try one thing, and if that doesn't work, they'll switch and try something else.
Yeah.
And so by being curious, persistent, and flexible, I think those are major ingredients of intelligence. And, you know, even in humans, I think that's how we are.
Problem solving,
yeah.
I suppose. So Heidi,
yeah,
Heidi
exactly.
managed to get the top off a jar. There's a crab in a jar, and she managed to get the top off it. They also change color very quickly because for camouflage, I suppose, to protect themselves against predators under the sea. But you noticed that Heidi was changing color while she was asleep.
I love their color changes. Yeah, Heidi was changing color when she was asleep. And I talk about this in Many Things Under a Rock as well. That, you know, depending on how you want to look at that and what your standards of evidence are, I argued that we should probably regard that as evidence of dreaming, the way that she was changing color. Not that we could definitely say that's what we saw, but that we could definitely gather the information we needed to evaluate that idea. So my idea was, if that process of color change while asleep follows ecologically relevant sequences. You do one set of things when you're foraging for food. Maybe you do a different set of things when you're fighting off a predator. And we see those same sequences reenacted while the animal is asleep in their small twitches and body changes, that's evidence that they're dreaming. And not only can we tell that they might be dreaming, like you do when you see your dog making running motions and twitching and whining, you think, oh, she's having a dream. But with an octopus, we might even be able to tell something about what they're dreaming about.
Fascinating. You're obviously fascinated by octopuses. They're amazing looking creatures. You've seen the documentary My Octopus Teacher, and in that there's a definite relationship between the human and the octopus, and there was a relationship between your daughter and Heidi, and maybe you as well. So what does that suggest to us? Final question, David Scheele.
Final question. Well, that's kind of what I wrote the book about. Many Things Under a Rock is about that. How do octopuses have relationships? What does it suggest about us and about them that octopuses are engaged in interacting with other animals? This is a group. The octopuses have been regarded as very solitary animals, exemplary solitary animals who hardly ever interact with each other. But then you go down at the sea in some of the places I work, like Octopolis, and we see them interacting thousands of times a day. And then you go out into the tropics and you get reports of them cooperating with grouper fish, for example, to find food. And so I started to wonder, you know, how do octopuses relate to each other? And, you know, in the film, the filmmakers wanted to make this story about a relationship between people and an octopus. And one of my colleagues said, well, you can relate to the octopus, but the octopus won't relate to you. And so I wanted to sort of think about that and examine that idea critically. And I, you know, the octopus is a different species, but I do think they relate to us. I don't think there's any doubt they relate to us.
It's a fascinating book, Many Things Under a Rock. How many years have you been working with octopuses, David?
I think this is the 29th.
Right. And octopuses is the correct plural, is it?
Octopuses, please.
Okay. Thanks, David. Thanks for getting up for us. Thank you. Bye now.
Thank you so much.
That's David Scheele in Alaska.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.